So before we jump in today to the section of Revelation that we're going to be picking up on, just want to bring a few announcements before you. First of all, tomorrow night we are resuming our youth nights. It's going to be a hangout night at McDonald's at 6:30. It's not going to be here. It's going to be at McDonald's here in Montague. So if you're coming out to that, we'd love to see you. As well, we're going to be doing Kids of Kindness packing on Thursday this week at 10 o'clock here at the church. So if you are interested in helping out with that, please show up for that. We're helping 15 students at the Montague Consolidated School have food for the weekends. Marjorie's heading that up. If you want to help out, you can talk with her or just show up or bring as much food as you can. That's always a help. This season that we're preaching through Revelation, we're going to be wrapping it up on Easter Sunday. So we have a few more weeks left. Easter is creeping up on us. It's crazy. And I just want to let you know about the services that we're going to be having Easter weekend. So we're going to be doing a Good Friday service here at 10 o'clock on Good Friday. And then Easter Sunday, 10 a.m., both at kind of our typical times of gathering. There's going to be registration links, as per usual, online that you can find for both of these services. For Good Friday, we're not going to be having a children's program. Nursery will not be staffed, but if you want to bring kids for the nursery, you can, and you can be down there with them. There will be no kids program, so the registration will be limited to what we can fit upstairs in the sanctuary, so smaller number. Just a heads up, we'll be doing our full thing Easter Sunday morning. Invite some friends. We're hoping to have a live stream up for then as well. So if you can't make it on Easter Sunday as well, we'll be looking forward to hopefully having that online for you to engage in. But because we're wrapping up the series on Easter Sunday, and we've all got plenty of things to do Easter Sunday, I want us to be able to kind of take a chance to dig in or ask some questions that have maybe arisen throughout our time going through Revelation. So next Sunday, after our service, we're going to do like a Revelation Q&A. Okay, so if you have any questions that have come up throughout the series, start writing them down, bring them to church with you next Sunday after the service. Once, you know, final song is done, you know, if you need to leave, you can leave. But, you know, if you want to hang around, we'll do kind of a Q&A time to ask questions that may have arisen throughout our series, and I'll try to answer them as best as I can. I can't guarantee you that I will have the perfect interpretation of how to explain the four living creatures and what each of the animals means and all those kind of things, which ultimately I don't think matters anyway. But bring your questions next week. We'll hang around after the service if you would like to ask some questions that way. All right, let's pick up this week in Revelation. We're in chapter 17. If you're going to be reading in a Bible, we'll also have it up on the screen. I'm going to read the first 8 verses for us. One of the 7 angels who had the 7 bowls came and said to me, "Come, I will show you the punishment of the great prostitute who sits by many waters. With her, the kings of the earth committed adultery, and the inhabitants of the earth were intoxicated with the wine of her adulteries. Then the angel carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness. There I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was covered with blasphemous names and had 7 heads and 10 horns. The woman was dressed in purple and scarlet and was glittering with gold, precious stones, and pearls. She held a cup in her hand filled with the abominable things and the filth of her adulteries. The name written on her forehead was a mystery: Babylon the Great, the mother of prostitutes and of the abominations of the earth. I saw that the woman was drunk with the blood of God's holy people, the blood of those who bore the testimony to Jesus. When I saw her, I was greatly astonished. Then the angel said to me, 'Why are you astonished? I will explain to you the mystery of the woman and of the beast she rides, which has 7 heads and 10 horns. The beast which you saw once was, now is not, and yet will come out of the abyss and go to its destruction. the inhabitants of the earth whose names have not been written in the book of life from creation of the world will be astonished at what they see when they see the beast, because it was not, and yet will come. We are picking up here in a strange, strange section in Revelation with plenty of imagery for us to be looking at. But I want to start talking about this. There is a phrase in advertising and marketing that says sex sells. You've probably heard it before or have experienced it yourself in your own understanding or viewership of the entertainment industry or in advertising. I did some research this week, and there is a man, Dr. Tom Reichert, who he literally wrote the book on sexuality in advertising. And from his studies, he says that about a third of the ads that we see contain sexually suggestive content. Haley and I were at the mall yesterday, and just even as we were walking by the stores, we're like, that store sells clothes to 14-year-old girls, but like it rivals La Senza in some of the way that it is advertising women. We see this increasingly, and I'm sure some of you who have lived longer than I have, this increasing sexualization in advertising. In fact, Tom Reichert in some of his research says that we are so desensitized to sexuality in our culture that advertising becomes more and more explicit, because it's like what used to grab our attention doesn't grab our attention the same way anymore. It's all designed to sell us something. It's to seduce us to become consumers. I want to read you this quote by Tom Reichert. He said, advertisers use sex because it can be very effective. Sex sells because it attracts attention, and people are hardwired to notice sexually relevant information. So ads with sexual content get noticed. There's something within us as human beings that's drawn to sexuality. Something, a good desire that God created in us. But it is being used and twisted for the purpose of selling us something. It's no wonder then, in light of this and what we're seeing, that the picture that we have in Revelation 17 and 18 of the downfall of Babylon is that of a prostitute. It is this perfect symbol of seduction, of drawing people in, of playing at their inner desires in order to draw them towards its purposes and away from God. It's playing at our hardwired desires, to use Tom Reichert's language, away from what we know is right. Now, this passage that we're reading and the next couple chapters talk about the judgment and the downfall of Babylon the Great, of this prostitute on the beast. And we're going to be looking at that today, but we need to kind of unpack and make sense of some of the pictures here of the prostitute, the beast, the heads, all that kind of stuff. So we have this picture of a prostitute on a beast. And this beast, that as we read about it, is scarlet. It has elements of, remember last week when we were talking about the dragon and the beasts that he calls out of the sea and out of the earth. It has elements both of the dragon to it and elements of the beast that he calls forth. So we can assume that this beast that we're talking about is in reference to Satan or evil forces that he's bringing about. Last week we talked about how Satan uses dark powers to influence empires, power structures, things like that. And so in some ways, Babylon the Great, this prostitute, is being propped up by the work of Satan, by the influence, the dark force of the enemy. The prostitute is said to have the words on her forehead, Babylon the Great. Now, if you were a first century Jew reading John's revelation as he sent it to the church, you hear Babylon, and that has all kinds of baggage for you. as a Jewish person. All kinds of baggage, because Babylon is kind of like the epitome of the enemies of Israel. A major part of Israel's history was a time when they had disobeyed God, and so God allowed Babylon to come and take over their homeland, to take them into captivity, to draw them away from their temple where they could worship God, to engulf them in a culture that was opposed to living the way that God had called them to live. Babylon for them was a symbol of what it meant to live according to the world's way and not according to God's way. They trace back the history of Babylon. Remember the story in Genesis, the Tower of Babel? This becomes like the origin story of Babylon, where human beings come together and they say, we're going to do our own thing, right? We're going to build this tower up to heavens to show the greatness of humanity. It is this picture of what Babylon means to represent. Something that was birthed in human rebellion and doing their own thing, that becomes a symbol of an empire oppressing Israel and overthrowing them and pulling them away from their customs and their morality and the worship of their God. They're known throughout their history as being oppressors of the poor, of having an ethic of sexual morality that was far from what God had called his people to. They were known for their persecution of the Jews, and they were the superpower always on the doorstep to the people of Israel. I have a slide here that shows just a bit of a map of the Babylonian Empire just after the time that they conquered Jerusalem. That this was the superpower they were worried about throughout their time, whether it was the time of King David, all the way through the kings that descended after him. Babylon was always a threat. Babylon was always the opposing culture, the way of the world different than how God had invited them to live. And so this picture of Babylon is placed on this symbolism of the prostitute that we see in Revelation. It carries all the baggage of the way of the world as opposed to the way of God. The way of drawing people out of their homeland, out of the worship of God in the temple, into the Babylonian Empire and the worship of other gods, the oppression of the poor, sexual immorality, the worship of idols. Now, there have been different ways throughout the history of the church then that people have interpreted this prostitute with the name Babylon on her. Some, especially during the times of the Protestant Reformation, said, well, it is a woman who has, you know, she's a prostitute, but there's imagery of a woman who's like the bride or the mother in Revelation. So maybe this is like the Catholic Church turned in its bad direction, and this is what it's trying to be. And so John is showing this picture in, you know, the 1500s and 1600s when the Catholic Church took some pretty bad turns. That's not the case. There are others who have thought that, you know, there have been certain influential women who have come about throughout history that have advocated for sexual liberty, that maybe this is what Revelation is talking about, that John is forecasting this thousands of years from now. Neither of those are great ways of understanding this picture. And this should go back, as we look at this, we should go back to how John and his first century readers would have understood it, how they would have pictured this symbolism. In fact, the angel who shows this picture to John gives us a bit of an explanation. This is one of the only places in Revelation where the angel's like, all right, this is what you're seeing. The angel says that the seven heads of the dragon are the seven hills upon which the prostitute sits. This is a very clear line drawn to the city of Rome. I have a slide here showing a map of Rome, which was known to be seated on seven hills. It was a well-known fact at the time, the city of Rome famously on its seven hills. The the angel also says that the seven heads don't just represent seven hills, but they also represent seven kings, which is confusing for us that the same thing can represent two things. But others have traced, okay, these seven kings, if you go from Caesar Augustus, who is the first emperor of the Roman Empire, and trace it through to the seven emperors after that, that gets us to around maybe the time when John was writing. He also writes that there will be an eighth king who was one of the seven who rises up again. And we had talked throughout our time through Revelation, this myth that Emperor Nero, who had died, was expected to come back again and to restore Rome. This could very well be what John is seeing here with this prostitute Babylon the Great. And it would make sense that this empire that John is experiencing in his day is carrying with it the baggage of the Babylonian Empire that the Jews faced, of drawing people away from the worship of God into its seduction and consumption. I want to read to you a quote from Tim Mackey, who's kind of the scholar in residence with the Bible Project. And it was a much longer quote, and I had to trim it down just for it to be able to fit on the screen. So he says, John's showing how Rome is simply the newest version of the Old Testament archetype of humanity in rebellion against God. Rome is just another iteration of Babylon. They come together and form nations that exalt their own economic and military security into a false god. We see it with Babylon, we see it with Rome, we see it today. This isn't something limited to the past or the future. It's a portrait of the human condition throughout history, and Babylons will come and go leading up to the day when Jesus returns to replace Babylon with his kingdom. So as we see this picture of the prostitute on the dragon, it's talking about Babylon and carrying all of the baggage with that into this picture. It's being understood as Rome by John and his first readers, but it's bigger than that. It's bigger because it shows us all the times throughout human history where humanity has formed ways of seducing and drawing people into its values, into its way of doing things, into its morality, and away from following their Creator. And this Babylon, whether it's Rome or others throughout the centuries, in Revelation 17 and 18, is condemned and judged by God for two main reasons: for seduction and consumption. These are the two things that come with it. And with consumption comes oppression. The prostitute that we see clothed in luxury, getting drunk off the filth of her adulteries from a golden goblet. The two big powers of Babylon and of Rome, and to the other Babylon-like powers that we see through human history, and even to this day, is this glorification of seduction and sexual power and of consumption. Let's talk about these for a minute. We're going to talk about sex and talk about consumption. There is a glorification in Babylon, in Rome, and in our culture today, like I was talking about earlier in advertising, with sexuality. Rome didn't just act like a hub for the importing and exporting of goods around the empire, which it did. But it also acted as an exporting influence of a lifestyle, of a way of life, of a set of values, of a morality that was contrary to the way of following the Lamb. In the West, even today, we export things like, you know, democracy, ideas to the rest of the world, economic ideals, but we also export a lifestyle, a value system, which some of us assume is a good morality, but is often more contingent on the cultural, consumeristic, sexualized way that we operate rather than our Western values that we hold dear. Let me give you an example. There are many Muslim majority countries that assume that Christians are perverts because they see the amount of sexuality in our advertisement and media and assume, well, you know, Europe and North America are Christian places. And so if this is the content that they consume, then these are the kind of values of Christianity. A caricature of Christianity is painted because the sexualization of our culture is attached to our religion. We see throughout film and Hollywood, we see even in the Me Too movement, that we do have this weird, messed up relationship with sexuality in our culture. We see it in social media influencers, in the impression that they have on kids around the world being exposed to North American social media influencers are starting to ask for what are called westernizing cosmetic surgery, where kids in Asia or in the Middle East are looking to have cosmetic surgery to make them look more Western, to make them look more North American, to make them look more European. We see it in the constant use of filters rather than just taking our own pictures. We see it in the incredible increase in girls seeking augmentations because of the sexualized nature of female bodies in our culture. We see it in the pornified culture that we have, where in having Tinder on our phones, in our pockets, it is normalizing, prioritizing sexual compatibility as a primary factor in relationships. That if things work out in the bedroom, then we'll see if things can carry on further. We see it in girls feeling the pressure to fulfill the porn-fueled expectations of young men. I read this morning in a study that 1 in 4 high school students send sexually explicit nude texts to others. 24%. We see this kind of Babylon-like sexuality, seduction in our culture. We see it playing at our own desires that are meant to alert us, to grab our attention to sexual content. We are living in Babylon. It's not just sexuality, but it's also consumption. And with consumption, we'll see oppression. In Revelation chapter 18, Babylon is condemned and God is bringing judgment on Babylon. And then there's this big list of, here's the glorious like trade network of Babylon or of Rome or of 21st century, the globalized world that we live in, where you can get whatever you want on your doorstep by Thursday. We read in Revelation 18, verses 11 to 13, says this: "The merchants of the world will weep and mourn for her. There is no one left to buy her goods. She bought great quantities of gold, silver, jewels, and pearls, fine linen, purple silk, and scarlet cloth, things made of fragrant thyan wood, ivory goods, objects made of expensive wood, bronze, iron, and marble. She also bought cinnamon, spice, incense, myrrh, frankincense, wine, olive oil, fine flour, wheat, cattle, sheep, horses, wagons, and bodies." That is, human slaves. We see the glory of the economy and the trade of Babylon or Rome or even us today. And in this kind of glorious list of luxuries, at the very end, we're struck that among those things traded is and bodies, that is, human slaves. And I think John very purposefully has this at the end to kind of hit us in the gut as we're like, wow, this is impressive. And all of a sudden, oof, and slaves. That there is a dark underbelly to Babylon's and Rome's and to our ability to consume what we want and get what we want. we begin to see that, in fact, all the things that we see on the list, the precious metals and jewels and pearls, the linens, the woods, the spices, are all available to us because of the oppression of human beings who make that possible. Rome was able to get things from India, not because of a fair trade economic system, but on the backs of slaves. And even us to this day, we live in this globalized world where we can get what we want on Amazon as quick as we need it. But sometimes we don't see the dark underbelly of what our consumerism costs. The globalized world that we live in makes an easy everywhere for those of us in the global West at the expense of the majority world. There is a dark underbelly to our consumption. And if you're willing to swallow the red pill and see how far the rabbit hole goes, it becomes difficult for us. Let me give you an example of our the fashion industry. We all wear clothes. And clothing is one of the worst polluting industries in the world. It's the second polluting industry only behind oil, where the clothes that we wear cause more havoc to the environment than almost anything else. 1 in 6 people in the world are part of the fashion industry. 1 in 6. So if there's 30 people in this room, you guys are the fashion industry. So out of the, what, billion people who work in the fashion industry, hundreds of millions of them work for less than $3 a day. And most of those who are in that bracket are women. As recent as the 60s, this is a U.S. stat, 95% of our clothes were made in the U.S. Now only 3% of our clothes are made made in the U.S. Almost all of our clothes are made in Southeast Asia. Don't do it right now, but when you get home, look at the tag in the back of your shirt. I will bet you it'll be Bangladesh or Vietnam, or somewhere similar in Southeast Asia. Our garments are sewn together by probably a woman trying to support her family, working 16 hours a day for pennies in abhorrent work conditions. We are able to get clothing cheaper than ever. It is actually cheaper to buy clothing now than it was 20 years ago because of the globalization, because of the dark underbelly of our consumerism. The goods, the glorious luxury, the easy everywhere, what we want at our fingertips that was there in Babylon to the rich, to Rome, and to us now, has a dark underside. Our consumption can fuel oppression. And so John's words to those who were living among Babylon in Revelation chapter 18, verse 4, is this. Then I heard another voice from heaven say, "Come out of her, my people, so that you will not share in her sins, so that you will not receive any of her plagues." The voice from heaven, the voice of Christ to those of us who lived in Babylon or Rome or today is to come out. To no longer be citizens of Babylon or live the way of Babylon, but to live the way of the Lamb. It makes me think of Jesus' words in his prayer in John chapter 17, where he's praying for his disciples. He says, "They are in the world, but they are not of this world, just as I am not of this world." We live in the midst of Babylon today. But what does it mean for us to faithfully follow the Lamb in a culture of seduction and consumption? What does it mean for us to follow the Lamb wherever He goes? So, questions for us to have to wrestle with today. What does it mean for us to be a witness to Jesus in Babylon when it comes to our sexual ethics? When it comes to being in a sexualized culture? Did you know that the early Christians were ridiculed in the Roman Empire for their sexual ethics? The fact that the men didn't have mistresses or a young boy that they kept around for sexual favors? That this was a countercultural move on behalf of God's people in the culture they lived in. There's a letter written in the early centuries of the church. It's called the Letter to Diognetus. I don't have it up on the screen. But this is someone talking about the strangeness of Christians. And he said, these Christians marry, as do all others. They beget children, but they do not destroy their offspring. They have a common table, but not a common bed. That they're willing to share with each other, but not in the way that others share, where dinner turns into another kind of party. But it was an express difference how they care for the life of their kids, how they cared for their spouses and their sexual relationships. Our call as followers of the Lamb is to live counterculturally in terms of our sexual ethic. Whether that is we follow the way of the Lamb by seeking to follow God's design for sexuality within marriage, whether that is we fight against the seduction of Babylon in a world where sex is everywhere. And maybe for us that means taking steps in terms of what we watch and what we consume. What does it mean to be a witness to Jesus in a culture based in consumerism? A culture based in consumerism. We are called consumers. We love to keep up with the Joneses. We like to have what other people have. Even I find now that we've moved to our new house, I want to make sure my driveway is clean when I see my neighbor across the street have his driveway clean. Man. Steve always gets there before me. And his driveway is bare. Anyway, I'm trying to keep up with Steve. But we live in a kind of world where, man, I see someone going down the street with a new iPhone. Mine's, you know, a couple years old. I should probably upgrade and get the new one. In fact, we live our lives. There's, like, Apple and Samsung are so good at, like, we've got something new for you now. We've got something new for you now. And you can buy into a system where, all right, well, if you pay us so much, then you can just always get the new one and always be the first one of your friends to get the new device. We're always upgrading. We always want what others have. We browse Amazon for fun like we would social media. Maybe it's just me. Maybe I'm just preaching to myself today, guys. But a countercultural response to the consumerism of our culture is contentment and gratitude. It's to say, I have enough because God has provided for me. It's to say, I'm thankful for the things that I do have. And not be seduced into the lie that Babylon has of you need the next thing. You need the iPad Pro because your iPad 9.7 isn't quite powerful enough. It does me fine. But the iPad Pro is so nice. Contentment and gratitude. We talk about it at Thanksgiving a lot, but it is actually a witness to the way of Jesus in the kind of culture that we live in. Haley is much better at this than I am, that I just can't hold on to cash because it doesn't make our bank account number go any lower, but you can still buy things. Here's the thing. We are always going to struggle with this tension because we live here, right? We live in the midst of Babylon. And whether it is with sexuality, whether it is with consumption and the dark underbelly of that, we are going to fail. We're going to have practices that we put into place where we're going to develop good habits that way. And the point of this sermon isn't to tell you that you need to now always buy fair trade, organic, like sew your own clothes, knit your own socks, and never watch TV again. The purpose is for us to say, the promise that the Lamb has for me is better than the promise of Babylon. The way that God has designed for me to live in my sexual life is better than what Babylon has for me. What God provides for me through His Son is enough for me. And I don't need to buy into the lie that I'm not going to have what I need and I need to keep getting more because I have what I need. Babylon is condemned. Babylon will fall. As Tim Mackey talked about, Babylon will come and go and be replaced by another Babylon until the time when Christ returns and establishes His kingdom. Babylon's days are numbered. So as followers of the way of the Lamb, let's live as citizens of the coming kingdom rather than of Babylon. Let's place our hope there because where we are right now is going to crumble. Let's live following the Lamb, knowing what He offers is better than what the prostitute on the dragon is trying to sell us. Let's pray. My God, You are enough. You give us what we need, and You actually care about us. You're not just trying to get something out of us. We're not just a consumer. We're not just a pawn in the system. We're not just a consumer. We're Your children. Children with value that You have seen worthy to send Your Son to come and die for, to redeem, to give life, to satisfy the depths of our desires in a way that the things of this world never could. And so, God, I pray for Your wisdom, for the guidance of Your Spirit, for Your work as we go about living life in the midst of Babylon, but not in Babylon. That we would, like the call from heaven, to come out of her. That we would live in the midst of this world, but not be of this world as You are not of this world. But I pray for just even practical steps of thinking twice, of Holy Spirit checking our hearts, that we might follow the Lamb wherever He goes in a way that shows the foolishness of Babylon and that would draw people to Your way of life. That they might find You and the great gift of Yourself in it. It's in Christ's name we pray. Amen.